Thank you, Sarah. Let's open with a word of prayer. Father, we thank you that you have given us this day the gift of life. May we use the privilege to your glory and to your honor and to our benefit. In Christ's name, amen. Well, suffering, we talked about a lot of different topics related to suffering. And I had this possibility, but I resisted putting anything up there because the topic is just too broad. It's too big for me to start a list. I mean, the list would wind up being, I think, from my own feeling, a bit on the superficial side. So, again, today I resist putting a list up of suffering. I want to review what we said last week, to repeat, for the sake of recalling the topics, at the same time to add some new things. One of the things that popped into my mind as I was thinking about this was something I read in Homer. Homer, you know, the Greek writer. Think about this. We suffer so much, it's better not to have been born. Now that's powerful, isn't it? And I did some research on it, and it's not just Homer. It's in several of the Greek, old Greek pieces of literature. Human beings suffer so much, it's better never to have been born. That's a bit strong, right? We could say God created the world to love it, and for the purpose of God's own glory. That is certainly Calvin, Luther, and that's our Protestant tradition. But we also said, as we said last week, the Bible is simply full of suffering. Almost to the point, as I used the image last week, if you could cover up half of it and you see nothing but suffering, and then you look at the other half and you're talking, it's healing, and it promise, healing and promise. I was just looking through the Bible, through John, the book of John, which has so much on this. And John 16, in the 16th chapter, talks about the suffering. In the world you suffer, but you will rejoice. And that same theme being picked up in the book of Revelation, the tears will be wiped away. So it's very much a biblical theme. Some strange things have come to mind as I've thought again about this topic. I think about my own preference for a traditional, what we call a traditional funeral. Now, I certainly don't mean to offend anybody by what I'm going to say, but just the traditional funeral is very biblically oriented, and the words are very biblical. And what I would call a modern funeral has a great deal to do with focusing on the person. And we want to celebrate the person, but so very often the way we celebrate the person is we forget the suffering, we forget the bad side, we don't want to talk about it. I remember a woman telling me before a funeral, please don't say he had cancer. Why? It's bad. It's bad to say that. We just don't want that. Well, I think her sensibilities weren't exactly what we know today. We're not afraid of the word as people used to be at one time. But let me tell you a little joke. This is supposed to have really happened. D-Men students, Doctor of Men students, ministry students from Scotland who come to Pittsburgh Seminary, there's this exchange. And they were telling the story about having a funeral for people that were only very distantly related to the church. And they requested a hymn. They wanted, "How Great Thou Art," sung at the funeral, and the minister asked them why. And they said, well, he was such a great person. He was such a great person. They wanted to sing how great that was. It was supposed to be a true story. I said, it can't really be true. They said, yeah, it's true. And it really happened. So the reality of suffering. It's interesting. Things we talked about before. Excuse me, I'm going to have to lift this up. My bifocals require this. We talked about suffering in its very public aspect, where it's not just a matter of individual personal suffering, but it's widespread. For example, war. War is certainly very personal, the suffering, but we know it's very widespread. Economic hardship, when suddenly people are out of work. Starvation because of famine. These things I would call very public forms of suffering because we all know about it, everybody sees it. But then there are those personal aspects of suffering that are extremely private, extremely personal, perhaps very difficult to talk about. If it's an illness where we have to do with a doctor, certainly we're talking about it to the doctor and hopefully also to pastors and to friends and so forth. But there are certainly forms of suffering that we don't particularly want to talk about or aren't too happy to talk about. Hopefully we've got a friend. You know, Luther once said, the gifts of the Spirit are scattered liberally in the congregation among the people. And I have always thought of Luther saying that when I have known back when I was a pastor that some of the most important pastoral work is from friend to friend, not to the pastor, but you have a good friend you talk to. Again, the gifts of the Spirit scattered liberally among the people where you minister to each other. You know, without that, I think the church is impossible. The gifts of the Spirit scattered liberally among the people. Romans 8, all of creation is suffering. All of creation following the promise given in the scripture for a new creation. Again, the tears will be wiped away. In the world you suffer, but be not afraid, I have overcome the world. Again, words of the Gospel of John. Very interesting here, the concept of temptation. Temptation we usually interpret as a matter of moral temptation. But that's not really Protestant tradition if we go back to Reformation. It is Protestant tradition if we look at kind of the Puritan tradition. Puritans tended to put the emphasis on morals, on moral behavior. Not entirely. There were exceptional cases among the Puritans, but it's something we inherit from the Puritan side. And it's certainly not just Puritan, it's also in the Catholic tradition. But we go back to Reformation. Luther, the way Luther interpreted lead us not into temptation was let us not lose faith. The great temptation for Luther was the loss of faith. And one of the ways, a major way, where we are tempted to lose faith is through suffering. Suffering tempts us to lose faith. Now, you'd think it would be reverse, but actually suffering leads to despair, right? If it leads to despair, you lose faith. And we begin to talk about images from the past, the dark night of the soul, which is this great theme that comes to us actually out of the Catholic tradition, but also is in the Protestant tradition too. Despair to the point where faith is lost, the darkness wins, and that as a product of human suffering. Very much part of the traditional discussion of suffering. Well, we talked about other things. to remind us of Hebrews 12, verse 6, where I think I said 12:1 last week, it's 12:6. God disciplines those whom he loves. God disciplines those whom he loves. Now, discipline means takes us into school, right? What is the school? It's the school of life. Now, that means we are going to suffer. Now, imagine a life without suffering. Now, often we do. I think we think, for example, very wealthy people don't suffer because they've got all the answers, right? They have every available means to overcome suffering. Well, certainly we also know that's not true. They suffer from the same human conditions everybody else does, although it's certainly nice whenever you're hungry to be fed, whenever you need the doctor to have the doctor immediately there, to have all the luxuries and so forth and so on. But we also know that luxuries can work the very opposite of what they're supposed to work, so that they can deepen the problem instead of alleviating any problems, making them profoundly worse. Despair. Augustine, talking about the suffering leading into despair. You know, in Colossians, the book of Colossians, I think it's in chapter 2, Paul writes, for the Christian, suffering leads to patience, leads to hope. So instead of a downward spiral, you have it going up. And I come back again to the thought of discipline, God disciplining us, going to put us through the paces. Suffering is going to be a part of life. For what purpose? And here again, we come back to the old question, is anyone naturally Christian? Is anyone by nature, simply by being born, Christian? What sorts of experiences make a person Christian? A very old discussion about people born Christian, reared in Christian families, never having a big experience of being born again. If they don't have the born again experience, are they really Christian? You think, well, that born again experience, that's very evangelical or Pentecostal or something. Actually, it goes back into the post-Reformation period, where we have major pietists saying, if you really have to be born again, just like it says in the Bible, if you don't have a born again experience, you're not really Christian. Back in Puritan New England, very first settlers in New England, they really had a rule. You had to be able to testify before the congregation and later on simply to the pastor that you had had a born-again experience. So it's quite old. And it's a long, long debate. What about just coming up as a Christian? Well, certainly this was true for me. I came up as a Christian. I have had religious experiences along the way, but I'm never quite sure I've had what some people describe as a big born again, because where suddenly the earthquakes and the lightning strikes, I don't think I ever had that one, but I've had certainly experiences along the way, and I think that means Christ takes us into that school so that we come to understand as Christians through our suffering too. This is part of our human life. Again, as the Bible talks about it, this is part of who we are as religious people and as human beings generally. One of the things I've heard said from the pulpit, if anybody on this earth should speak of the reality of human life as suffering, it should be Christians. Because they speak so much about promise, healing, overcoming sin, all of these things. So if anybody should be honest about the reality of human suffering, it should be Christians. Again, because the Bible itself is full of it. I come back to despair. Augustine, St. Augustine, is famous for saying, you have to go down before you can go up. You have to experience going down. That is to say, you have to experience, actually he meant despair, before you can go up. Now that's been debated throughout Christian history. Is that true? Do you have to go down before you can go up? There's a theologian, a very famous theologian of the 20th century, Emil Brunner, who preached that. He said, the purpose of a sermon is to break people down so that you can lift them up. Well, that sounds like an American tradition of hellfire preaching. It's very close to traditional hellfire preaching. There was a very famous preacher back in the 19th century, Charles Finney. Charles Finney was associated with Oberlin College for a time. He was an evangelist, mainly in New York State. Very famous evangelist. And he absolutely, in his sermons, was very famous for it, breaking people down in order to preach grace to lift them up. Now, that's traditional hellfire preaching. Now, it didn't have to be hellfire always, but that was the point. And he was, you know, they describe him. They said he had pale blue eyes, right? And he would stare at people. He would stare at them to break them down. He would select people in the audience to stare at, right, in the congregation. And the point was to break them down. Well, I don't think Augustine exactly meant that. What he meant was, in experiences of life, to despair means to lose all securities, all the other securities, and then to rely on God's promises and to be lifted up by God. Now, there is one understanding of what it means to be disciplined by God, to be taken into the school of life, where suffering has the meaning of making us open to accepting God. Kierkegaard, this great, great theologian from the 19th century. We forget Kierkegaard, and we don't know really anymore what he said and what he did. It's a very worthwhile pursuit just to read and study Kierkegaard. But one of the things he talked about was the concept of anxiety. And his whole analysis of human life was that at the bottom, at the core, and he's talking about sin, by the way. He wrote this book called The Sickness Unto Death. The sickness unto death for Kierkegaard was anxiety. Anxiety at the core of human life that makes us seek answers that aren't real answers. So, for example, at the core of all human life is something driving us to find security. And security, as Kierkegaard analyzed it, was the superficial things of life. To fit in, to be affirmed by the society, to do the things that the society wants us to do. I remember in a class, we were talking about this once at seminary, and a student said, well, it's kind of like a girl, she was a woman, a girl in high school wanting to be a cheerleader more than anything, because that affirmed who I was. This was personal affirmation. All kinds of ways we have of seeking security. And these security elements, or world elements, and part of the great discipline, as Kierkegaard talked about it, that God takes us into, is that experiences of suffering of all different kinds personal depressions, despair, losses, loneliness. All of these things break down those securities. And it may sound superficial. It may sound, you know, kind of taken out of the air. But the Bible teaches us constantly that the answer to all those searches for security is Christ and the message of God's love in Christ. Now, this is very interesting. When we look, go back into history, we see this matter of suffering being talked about constantly, although we don't like to talk about it all too much in our personal lives. And so much draws us away. Television, right? One of the things my wife and I were mentioning, we read in a newspaper where Downton Abbey is kind of interesting, right? I finally got hooked on it a little bit myself. I thought for a long time it was soap opera, but I wasn't going to watch it. But it called it the Great Escape. People are escaping into the beautiful world of Downton Abbey. Of course, not all that beautiful, all kinds of problems in it. But nevertheless, television functions like that. It's kind of a way of getting away from ourselves, getting out. All kinds of ways of getting away from those things that we don't like to be identified with, the sufferings that we're going through. One, you know, computer occupation, you know, all kinds of things are there. So again, suffering so much a part of our lives, so much a part of what we experience. Let's come again to the concept of healing. What is the message of the New Testament relative to the suffering we go through? The core message is the gift of Christ. Grace. You know, I had one time somebody said, you know, whenever ministers get into some sort of pickle about what they're talking about, they always come up with grace. Well, so that's grace. That's grace. And somebody, tell me what grace is. What do you mean by grace? Well, grace is God's love. Well, okay. Well, can you make it a little more concrete, right? And the most concrete way of saying it is the grace of God is Christ, the gift of Christ, the gift. As in parables, for example, the parable of the workers in the vineyard. You know, the workers in the vineyard, some work all day and get the full pay. Some work half a day, they get full pay. Some come in an hour or so before the day is over. They get sent into the vineyard to work and they get the full day's pay. And of course, this is wrong, isn't it? Because they work a full day. Those who worked a full day earned that. Those who didn't work but an hour or two, they didn't get the full day's pay. But this is a parable of Jesus. What does it have to say? It talks about grace, the gift of God, God's gift to us without us deserving it, right? The gift of Christ. But this gift is given in the midst of all of our suffering as the great promise, the great healing. Now, I want to move once more into a new subject. I want to talk a bit about Calvin on suffering. And then I'm going to ask for some discussion and questions and any remarks you'd like to make. But Calvin is extremely interesting at this point. You know, Calvin has this doctrine of providence. Now, here's other doctrines that have often been discussed, like predestination and so forth. But providence, I think, is the most interesting he's got. Providence means God's foresight and will for all of our lives. Now, providence has traditionally been talked about in two ways. One is general providence, and one is particular providence. General providence is overall, God's providence for the great course of the world, the course of wars, the course of general development, God's foresight and guidance. Particular providence is your personal life. Your personal life, as foreseen by God, willed by God. Now, Calvin talked about this very, very frankly. Luther did early on, and then later he kind of abandons the thought. But just think of this. Your life providentially what? Willed by God. Now, he said, the major thing going on here, and what is most important to understand, is God's absolute care for you in whatever happens. God's full, particular care for you in all that happens. Absolute care for you personally. Not just in a general way, but for you personally and all that happens. Now, the problem with it, you know, Calvin has, this is often called hyper-Calvinism. Everybody rejects it, except very hardcore hyper-Calvinists, that God has determined the course of life, even also yours. Now, Calvin knew it was a difficult doctrine, and I don't mean to tell you to accept it, but I want to give you his reasoning, the way he looks at it. One way he looks at it is through the Bible, that nothing according, for example, to the book of Job, all of Job's suffering is, Job doesn't understand it. Job has no way of comprehending it. And we come to the end of the book of Job, and Job simply says, I realize I don't understand God. I don't understand God's ways. But I worship God. There's an additional ending to the book of Job that most scholars think was added later, where God praises Job for Job's suffering through everything and holding to faith, that he was tempted and he held to faith. But the back at the core meaning of the book seems to be meaningless suffering. I don't know why this is happening. He lost his means of life, he lost his health. Everything is loose, and people are telling him, do this, do that. And he says, that's not it. You don't understand. That's not the problem. He holds to faith all the way through Job's suffering. Calvin wrote a book on Job, commentary on the book of Job, where he talked about God's profound involvement in everything we suffer. Now, he went so far as to say, there is a way in which God has foreseen every single life, all of our lives. Of course, the problem, you were your generation after Calvin, everybody's saying this is impossible, it denies human freedom. But Calvin himself saw it at two levels. He said, no one will ever understand God's ways. This is an Old Testament saying. My ways are not your ways. I think it's in Isaiah. You try to follow God's ways, it's enter into a thicket where you can't find any way. And Calvin said, it's an abyss. You know, an abyss means you can't find your way in anything. A labyrinth. You can't find it. You don't find your way. If you try to reason as God reasons, if you try to understand providence, you're going to do nothing but get confused. The only thing you can do is to trust God. That's Calvin's message. The only thing you can do is to trust God in all the suffering you go through, to take it as God's discipline. That's where he uses that Hebrews text, 12:6. God disciplines us, leads us through the very suffering we experience ever deeper into faith, into glorifying God, into loving God, into being dependent on God, like Job. Now, Job is the worst, right? And I say again, the profundity of the Bible is not to cover things up. It speaks extremely frankly about what human suffering is. Now, according to Calvin, the area of providence is God's own. We exercise our freedom to do what is right. Always. It is our responsibility. Never, ever. And this is a misunderstanding of Calvin, to say that, well, God has foreseen all this, I'm just going to sit and wait and let things happen. That would be a complete misunderstanding of what Calvin means. We have responsibility in every sense of the word to make use of the freedom we have. For example, in our social ethics, which is becoming a major issue today, I think, in the election, presidential issues, the freedom, social responsibility, of what to do and what not to do. We're all being confronted with these questions in a new way, perhaps in an old way, and just happening again. But absolutely, we have our freedom to use, to do our duty. And one of the things Calvin clearly says is that ministers should admonish people, you should do this, you should do your duty. You should, there's never a matter of kind of sitting by and letting God's will for things take their course. Because part of that is your action and your own freedom. So it's human freedom together with this overarching sense of God's complete care for us in everything that happens. So you think of that text, Matthew 10:29, I think it is, no sparrow falls to the earth without your Father. That's a very interesting text, without the Father, without God, because there's nothing between in that. It doesn't say without the will of God or without the knowledge of God. It just says without God. The hairs of your head are counted. Right? These are texts that Calvin very much used to talk about God's absolute care. Care to the point even of the things that happen to us. The things that we go through are not without God. Particular providence, not just general providence. All right, let's imagine the situation where there is no providence. There is no God. God is there, certainly, but God does not care for me personally unless I turn to God, I accept what God says, then I get God involved in my life, and then I begin to exercise my freedoms and so forth. Well, this is also very common in the Protestant tradition. It's generally associated with free will doctrine. Complete free will doctrine. As long as I exercise my free will for God, for Christianity, I will reap the benefits. I will have the benefit. And then, of course, you get the whole tradition of backsliding. Backsliding means losing, you know, your commitment. Stop going to church. Have a little bit too much to drink. All of those things, backsliding. And this gets developed into a moral code. Christianity becomes a matter of moral behavior again. Doing the things right. Everything depends on my doing things right and correctly. we start picking up the old emphasis that comes from the Puritans on the morality. And if we forget, or we tend to get away from that doctrine of grace. Calvin, again, it's also Luther, but Calvin's great, great doctrine is the union with Christ. That life itself, taken as God's discipline, in all that we suffer, leads us not downward, but upward into the unity with God in Christ. So glorifying God is not a moral obligation, maybe, but it becomes a part of the life we learn through God's great gift of Christ, of grace, of God's love. Now, I think there is one more topic I want to hit on, and then I'll open it up for discussion. What about the Zika virus? Now, war we talked about, and as the prophets tell us that the consequences of sin is destruction, and we can apply that to things like the war, like we did last Sunday, with the Second World War and the persecution of the Jews. That here we see clearly human sin and suffering, widespread human suffering, terrible human suffering on the part of the Jews, but not just the Jews, in the Second World War, and certainly under Stalinism later. I'd say the lives lost under Stalin were greater than those lives lost under Nazism. But we see there, we have a biblical paradigm that the prophets talk about, the consequences of sin, destruction. And remember the prophetic one-sided covenant. The covenant is always God's covenant with us. The prophets never talk about if you do this when everything is gone, right? The destruction comes. If the people will just lift themselves up again, I will do this. It's always reversed. I will save. I will restore my people. The destruction is predicted by the prophets, the great destruction, but always, always with the prophets, I will restore. And that is finally the message in the New Testament, the promise of Christ. I will restore the new creation, the life beyond this one. Your tears will be dried, the sorrow will be overcome. But there are areas where we question, and I would say the Zika virus is making us question things. Does God have anything to do with the Zika virus? And people who are affected, and as we watch news stories about people that are affected, is God involved in that? Is there absolutely meaningless suffering? Is there a Zika virus without God? We use that expression from Matthew 10:29, as I remember it. No sparrow falls to the earth without God. There is no Zika virus without God. What do you think? Now, you know, one of the things we said last week is that suffering certainly brings us to a point where we don't have any words, and where it's better not to have words, right? To suffer with rather than just to talk. To stop talking and to suffer with and to be quiet. Where we are brought to silence. Well, this Zika virus is terrible, isn't it? It's babies that are being affected, that are never going to be normal, have no chance of it. Well, maybe I come to silence at this point. I can hear Calvin. Calvin says, even the worst is God's own way with human being. We don't understand it. We cannot enter into it other than to say that it is maybe part of the discipline of life. But why should such suffering be imposed? That is why Calvin has been rejected over the centuries in this regard, Calvin's doctrine. And what the fascinating question for me is, what's Calvin really thinking of here? What about a world in which God, in every sense of the word, is with us, with will and with God's total, absolute care? What about starvation? Now, as I said, Calvin got rejected emphatically in the 18th, 19th, and also 20th centuries. Presbyterians, traditionally back in the beginning, were very much Calvinists. So were Baptists. Baptists were very much Calvinists. Congregationalists, originally. But all that's been lost in terms of that kind of identification of God with what happens, particular providence. Now, it seems to me we have to do here with a mystery, and I don't have final answers. I just have nice questions, right? They say the more educated you are, the better your questions, or the more questions you have, or the better you are at making up questions, right? They also say the more educated you are, the better you are at complaining. You can complain better than anybody, right, if you're very well educated. Okay, let me ask for any kind of response you want on any of this. I hope I don't lead you into the labyrinth and you're lost too, you know, so I'm completely lost with these questions. Yes?
We're talking about Joe a little here. I'm not sure it really answers the question, but there's a shade of meaning that comes out in Joe where Joe's suffering is not something that God imposes, but God allows the devil, Satan, or whatever, to impose it. And in the end of the story, I don't know that God ever answers Job's questions. He sort of puts Job in his place, but doesn't really answer the very specific question, the hard one that we're asking.
Right. I have no answer back for that. Yes. Right.
To me, that says, it gets back to what Ted said last week. Perhaps suffering has no meaning to be known.
Say that again.
Perhaps suffering is meaningless. I think that's what you said. There's no meaning to suffering. That's what you were suggesting.
I'm sitting here wondering about that.
Suffering is very much a human condition, and I think, again, I would emphasize that. The Bible talks about it constantly, right? Come back here. If any group of people should be open about it, it's the Christians, because the Bible talks about it so constantly.
Did Calvin repress suffering?
Yes. He lost two children in infancy, for example. He lost his wife. He was in ill health for the last 10 years of his life, very close to death. I don't think he had an exemplary life. I mean, we wouldn't say... It's an old problem. When we talk about Christian heroes, that they're perfect, right? We like to make them moral paragons. It's not really true of any of them. And I think that's important, too, to understand that in our Protestant tradition, all human beings are sinful, and this has also to do with healing. that we all need the healing, all need the... there's sometimes in the tradition, you know, back in the early church, there was a problem of docetism. From the word docetic means seems. It seems Christ seems to be human, but he's not really because he's perfect. He seems to be human. This went so far as to say he didn't really need to eat. He was only seemed to have a body. He didn't really have a body. Was Christ sexual? Did he have any sexuality? No. So this gets picked up, you know, with the marriage of Jesus stuff, which I think is very mythical. I don't think any of that's true. You know, the Da Vinci Code stuff, I think that's la-la. But still, it has the tradition of docetic seems to be... Well, there's a tradition also of our Christian heroes. They're actually docetic. They don't do anything wrong. There's nothing wrong with them. And just to spoof a bit, do we have Methodists present? I'm an old Methodist, so I can tell a story. John Wesley divorced, had a divorce, right? He was a terrible marriage, and finally got divorced. And this is not talked about a lot among Methodists, right? There was a time when they buried this totally. Again, it has to do with the moral. The emphasis on the moral. I'll tell you another story. Well, no, I'm going to hold off on my stories. Let me ask you again for your responses. Yes, Jim.
Well, granted, Zika virus could not exist without God. Nothing could. But there's human intervention that promotes the spread of the virus. And may not apply to Zika, but talk about malaria was so rampant in Central America that they couldn't complete the original effort on the Panama Canal, but they controlled the mosquito population to the point that malaria and yellow fever did not become an issue, and then they were able to finish the canal. But then the government said, well, there's no threat of malaria, so they cut the funding for the programs to control the mosquito population, and malaria came back. And so, God is not behind all this human intervention that is, may not be classically called sin, but it is certainly negative engineering.
Human failure. Yeah, the exercise of human freedom. Again, if I come back to Calvin, Calvin never denies the point you're supposed to do your duty, responsibility as you see it. And that also means science today, right? The exercise of responsible science in controlling mosquito population, or who knows today, climate change, right? The degree to which human responsibility is involved here to correct it or not correct it. Again, social situations, what we are called to. You would, in Calvin's sense, if I refer back to him, because we're talking about this comprehensive sense of providence, absolutely it is our social responsibility to pick up the problems of the poor, to deal with the problems of poverty in other nations, to see the human responsibility, to, it doesn't exclude this at all, that it includes it, right? This would be including the work of free will, certainly, but trusting God in my life and in the life generally. I come back to Calvin because it fascinates me, not because I come down on the points of Calvin and say, yes, I believe that, because it is a mystery. I don't know. But he said, preach it. When Luther wrote about it, he tended to write in Latin. And if church people tended to write in Latin, the point was, who's the audience? The audience are the people who read the Latin, the educated. And Calvin said, you preach it. Tell the people God's absolute care in everything that happens to you. And it's a fascinating thought. It's scary the same time. And I have heard again and again in the history of Christianity this thought being rejected. Calvin is the great dark, this dark cloud around Calvin because of this predestination, pre-providence thought. And yet that's not Calvin when you read him. That's not what he's like when you follow his thought. Okay, yeah. Sure, thalidomide. Those of us who remember that, remember the horror of it, right? Just absolutely horrible. And could you possibly say, how was God involved? Well, you begin to think, and I'm not saying you accept the line of rationality, but the rationality goes, human failure, right? We become extremely powerful through technology, and we're becoming ever more powerful. But the more powerful we become, the greater the misuses, the failures, the guilt. Just think of the, you know, I think my generation growing up into adolescence and so forth after the Second World War, we used to practice what it would be like if the bomb came, you know, the big one. Get under the desk. We used to have drills like that. So any of you remember that? Right? We drilled. Now, getting under the desk wasn't going to help much, but... and we learned that too. It wasn't going to help much. But that's what we did. And all kinds of people were building bomb shelters, right? Interesting, there's... when I was pastor in Switzerland, some of you know that, we had a manse with a bomb shelter in the cellar. And what had happened was back in the big scare, they had built the manse with a large bomb shelter as a community project, so that if the bomb came, you know, all the people would come to the manse and get in the bomb shelter. Well, it was a place to store things when we lived. It had this massive steel door, you know, to open and close. Others? Yeah. I've heard the expression, but I don't know what it means either.
Yeah.
Yes, that's again, come back to Luther's understanding of temptation. It's also, in Calvin, temptation is to lose faith. Right? It's not a moral matter of doing bad things. Like in South Park, right? That's bad. The big thumb comes out of the sky and squashes you because you're morally bad. No, temptation is to lose faith, is loss of faith. Suffering, how often do I hear, in some way or another, through literature or people saying it, if God were true, I were real, this wouldn't have happened. God wouldn't have allowed it. Well, certainly the consequences of sin are legion. They are all around us. And one final point, I realize we're at time, and I don't want to cut off conversation if you want to keep it going, but there is an old truth that to be a pastor, whether you're a professional pastor or whether you're pastoring to each other, as you know, the gifts of the Spirit liberally scattered in the congregation, is that you're not going to be a very good pastor if you haven't suffered. Suffering makes a pastor, because it makes you understand suffering. Right? Again, God disciplines those whom He loves. I think again that's Hebrews 12:6. God takes us into the school of life, and that part of that is suffering. Well, any further comments or responses? You want to get up and run out screaming? And well, thank you. You've been very attentive. Right.